Covered with Rabbanit Nechama Goldman Barish, a new three-part mini-series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For source sheets to accompany this podcast, visit www.elmad.pardes.org/uncovered.
The series that we're starting here in these podcasts are regarding a topic of halacha referred to as the Erva laws, literally the laws of nakedness. And I'm going to start off with the question of whether women can wear pants or not, because I think that reflects a greater conversation that I'm going to develop in the course of these podcasts, is the halachic conversation versus the religious conversation. And, you know, different people may use different terminology, so I'd like at the outset to define a little bit about how I use the term halacha and how I use the term religious. When I talk about halacha, I'm talking about a particular legalistic conversation. It has an internal structure. It has language. It evolves from the Torah onward through the Mishnah and the Talmud and the Gaonim and the Rishonim and the Achronim. And it follows a particular type of development. It has a way of using source material and considering source material. And so it resembles legal conversations outside of religion. I mean, precedents are important. Minority opinions are important. And so when people say, what does the halacha say? Often what they're talking about is, can I open the Shulchan Aruch and find the answer? In contrast, we often have things we do for non-halachic reasons, but they are religiously significant. And I often say when I teach these topics that they're also legitimate, religiously legitimate. In other words, our religion, our religious practice, is not only made up of the legal's do's and don'ts that we define as halakha, but it's also made up of customs that are brought from one community to another. And it's made up of religious concerns in particular spaces. So for instance, dress, how men and women dress in a particular community is less a halachic conversation and more of a religious conversation. So in Hasidic communities, the way the men dress, which is no less burdensome than the way the women dress, often reflects the identity towards a particular Hasidic sect. And that becomes very, very important in terms of my showing my identity and my commitment to the norms and customs and interpretations, halachic and other, that I incorporate into my daily life as a Jew living in that community. So when we talk about women's dress in general and pants in particular, what we're going to see is that it's not a strictly halachic conversation. And while we're going to go through the halachic source material, by the time we get to the modern conversation, which is probably about 100 years old, whether women can wear pants or not, we're going to understand that religion, religious space, is interested in how members of the community dress and comport themselves. And as I'll continually iterate, I think it's legitimate to have those concerns. And even more importantly, when we're talking about women and women and men interacting, I would say Judaism is very concerned, or halachic Judaism, religious Judaism, is very concerned with desexualizing both sacred and non-sacred space. And women represent a source of sexuality and for the men in the community. And the question is, how can we desexualize space so men and women can come together respectfully and with kovod rosh, you know, appropriately, and create the kind of boundaries that will remind them continuously that from the moment they wake up until they go to sleep, their lives, their thoughts, their actions are meant to be directed towards a relationship with God, even while we're having relationships horizontally with one another. We're going to start with a source in Brachot 24a. It's a source we're going to come back to for the next three podcasts, today's and then the one on hair covering and the voice of a woman. It's the source of nakedness. And first, we need a few moments to talk about context. The source appears in chapter 3 of Brachot. And in chapter 3 of Brachot, we have laws pertaining to Kriyat Shema, when do people say Shema and when are they exempt from saying Shema? So first of all, when a person buries his dead, first degree relative, he is exempt from saying Kriyat Shema until after the burial. So that's really the beginning of the chapter. In the course of the conversation, we actually find out women are exempted from Kriyat Shema, as are minors and as are Canaanite slaves. And the chapter continues to explore sources of nakedness, literally nakedness, the naked body, and we'll proceed to also talk about a different kind of erva, which is less nakedness and more something abhorrent, and that refers to body waste, bodily wastes, wastes eliminated from the body, and the fact that they too create a deterrent to saying Kriyat Shema. So on 24a, we have just gone through several pages in which literal bodily nakedness has been explored. In other words, if two men are sleeping next to one another in an inn and they're both naked, can they say the nighttime Shema? If a man and a woman are lying next to one another naked, a husband and a wife, can they say Shema? Well, it wouldn't be they, of course. Can he say Shema? And the solution there is actually they should turn backside to backside and say Shema, and the man can then say Shema, with a suggestion that backsides are not nakedness in the same way that frontal nudity is nakedness. And then the Gemara goes on to talk about whether a woman, when she's naked, can make a bracha to take challah, which is a very interesting visual. And the answer is yes, she can, because she can crouch down and cover her nakedness, her bodily nakedness, breasts not being nakedness, but the lower part of the body, the sexual organs being the absolute source of nakedness. And so a woman can crouch down and cover her nakedness, something a man cannot do. He's unable to cover his nakedness because of the structure of his anatomy. And then it goes into parents and children in a bed. The understanding at that time was people did sleep naked under the covers, probably to save on laundry and the cost of material. So maybe the upper middle class would have pajamas, or what we call night garments, but lower class would sleep either in their clothes or not in their clothes. And then can I say Shema when I'm in bed with my children if we're all naked? And then finally, we come to the four statements we're about to read regarding different sources of nakedness. And I want to point out, meaning we have four Amoraim, really Rav Yitzchak, Rav Sheshet, Rav Chista, and Shmuel, who reflect on different types of nakedness. And it's a continuation of the sugya, the unit on Kriyat Shema, or the units on Kriyat Shema that we've been exploring. And then we move on to a new topic altogether. The Gemara does not then start inflating or overanalyzing or interpreting the four statements we're about to read. Instead, the Gemara goes on to talk about tefillin in the bathroom, which is another conversation. Can you bring your tefillin into the bathroom? And so this sugya, these four statements, which end up becoming so powerfully represented or presented to young women the world over, young Orthodox women the world over, really only appear once together in the Bavli. The line about the voice of a woman appears in one other space and one other place, one other Masechet in Kiddushin, but we'll talk about that another week in a different podcast. And what we have here are four statements that never go anywhere in the Talmud and yet become the foundation for what is Erva and what isn't, well outside the boundaries of Kriyat Shema, well after the Talmud. So let's take a look at the first source. Rav Yitzchak said, a hand breadth exposed, a tefach exposed in a married woman constitutes erva. And right away the Gemara asks, well, in what way? Well, gazing at it, gazing at a tefach, a hand's breadth of a woman exposed, and which part of her body are we talking about? And then the Gemara reminds us that Rav Sheshet has already told us that ornaments worn outside the clothes are equaled with those worn inside. In other words, a kind of internal piercing on the sexual organ would be equated with a bracelet or a necklace. And the conclusion is, according to Rav Sheshet, that if you gaze at the little finger of a woman, it's as if he gazed at her secret place. So we already know that. We already know that having sexual thoughts can emerge even when one gazes at a hand's breadth exposed in a married woman. Okay. And the Gemara says, no, it can't be that simple. Rav Yitzchak can't be telling us something that obvious, because Rav Sheshet has already told us. No, it means even his own wife, someone whose nakedness he's familiar with, he can't look at a hand's breadth of her flesh exposed when he's saying Kriyat Shema. The laws of Kriyat Shema are so weighty and require so much kavana that when he says Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, he must have utmost concentration, and even a hand's breadth exposed in a woman whose flesh he's familiar with could potentially provide us a distraction. And so it is erva. It's nakedness, even though it's not the nakedness we've been discussing of exposed nudity. It's really just nakedness in the sense of distracting me from Kriyat Shema, and it's the nakedness of a female body, but again, not nudity, nakedness as in a hand's breadth of flesh exposed. Rav Chisda then goes on to say, a thigh in a woman is erva, meaning shok b'isha erva. He quotes a pasuk from Yeshayahu, bear your thigh, wade through the rivers, or bear your shok and wade through the rivers. Your erva shall be uncovered and your shame shall be exposed. And so, Yeshayahu is not the classic source for any sort of serious halachic conversation. That's why, again, I'm going to repeat this idea that I don't believe this is a halachic statement. I think it's a statement, if we're already talking about sources of nakedness and Kriyat Shema and things that distract me, and what sexual space looks like, then the thigh of the woman represents her sexuality, and having that exposed is certainly going to be distracting. Shmuel then goes on to say, Kol b'isha erva, and he quotes a pasuk from Shir HaShirim, Ki kolech arev umarech na've, your voice is sweet and your appearance is comely. So Shmuel talks about the voice of a woman, and again, he brings a pasuk from Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim is not a source of halachic analysis or interpretation. And finally, Rav Sheshet, we hear from Rav Sheshet again in the context of this conversation, Se'ar be'isha erva, the hair of a woman is erva. And then it brings an odd pasuk, Se'arech ke'eder ha'ezim, your hair is like a flock of goats. Why that's considered to be beautiful to have your hair be like goats, we're not going to go into right now. But again, it's a pasuk from Shir HaShirim, from the Song of Songs, and it's not a classic source. We don't learn halacha from Nach, with very, very few exceptions. And so my understanding when I finish this section, this paragraph, is that we started off by defining what erva is for the purpose of Kriyat Shema. And we said even a married woman to her husband represents a potential source of distraction, so that even an uncovered hand's breadth of flesh, wherever it is in her body, will distract him from his kavana of Kriyat Shema. So again, this ties into what we've been talking about in the chapter. What is distraction? What is nakedness for the purpose of Kriyat Shema? And then the editor of the Gemara brought in three other statements that kind of tie in. If we're already talking about erva, well, I've got Rav Chisda, I've got Shmuel, I've got Rav Sheshet, all bring different examples of where there's potential sexual distraction with regard to a woman. But again, it doesn't have any sort of halachic nafkaminas, any sort of halachic consequence. And yet, as I said earlier in the conversation, these become the sources for why women shouldn't sing, why women have to cover their hair, why women shouldn't wear pants or shouldn't wear short skirts. And of course, my question with a critical eye to the source is it justified by the Talmudic conversation, or is the Talmudic conversation really a platform for later concern for how to desexualize a space in which men and women find themselves? Where I'd like to go from here is really that if we would try to find sources, if we try to find halachic sources on dress code, how the daughter of Israel should dress, we'll come up with ideas like kol kvoda bat melech pnima, the dignity of the daughter of a king is inward, okay, whatever that means, which suggests women shouldn't be too public, too ostentatious, too loud, perhaps. We also come against a pasuk, a verse, hatsne alechet im Hashem Elokecha, you shall walk modestly with the Lord your God, from Micha. In the traditional Talmudic sources, these have nothing specifically to do with women's dress. The walk modestly with God has to do more with modesty in money, in how you handle your money. Modesty when it comes to weddings and funerals, places where people can sometimes ostentatiously and lavishly spend to show how happy or how sad they are. And with Kol Kvodam Ba'Melech Pnima, really, again, an aspiration or a warning that women belong much more in private space than in public space. Much later on, of course, it becomes both those psukim are used to talk to young women about tzniut, about being tznius, about being modest. But I always think it's important to reiterate that we don't have really a classic halachic conversation about how many centimeters need to be exposed or covered when it comes to the body of woman. There is an understanding from the sugya we just read that the body of a woman, the voice of a woman, the hair of a woman can all represent sexual distraction, as can woman capital W. And those sources come up regularly in the Talmud, that woman capital W is a source of distraction. So if I open the Mishneh Torah, or if I open the Shulchan Aruch, and I'm looking for some sort of halachic analysis of how women should dress, I'm not going to find it. What I'm going to find is these ideas of erva appearing in the laws of Kriyat Shema, which is exactly where I'd expect to find them. That when it comes to saying Kriyat Shema, a man should not hear the voice of a woman, should not see the hair of a woman, married or unmarried, not clear from the Talmudic section we just read, and should not see even a hand's breadth bared of a woman, and perhaps, you know, covering his eyes is one way of warding off any sort of distraction from those kind of sources. And so really, if I wanted to summarize at this point, I would say what seems to happen in the wake of the halachic conversation, which is about Kriyat Shema, is we essentially then, certainly in the last 100 years, expect women to dress 24/7 in a way, or speak in a way, or behave in a way that a man could say Kriyat Shema 24/7. And of course, men don't say Kriyat Shema 24/7. They are strictly limited by time to saying Shema in the morning and saying Shema in the evening. And but we turn all of the space into possible Kriyat Shema space by using the Talmudic conversation and the halachic discussion of the Talmudic conversation to define how women should dress. And again, questions of whether that's justified or not will definitely depend on what any given community looks like. But I will say that it's important to try to follow how we got from point A to point Z, right? How we got from, let's talk about how women should dress in Sinias and Erva, when really in the Gemara it's a very particular conversation, and in the halachic literature as well, it's confined to the laws of Kriyat Shema, which of course men only say at very specific times of the day. Okay, before we move onward to look at the very specific conversation that comes up in the 1900s about pants and continues into our century, I want to talk about cross-dressing, because really when it comes to pants, one of the major questions is, does it violate the clear biblical prohibition against cross-dressing? And so we have a pasuk in Dvarim 22:5, Kaf Bet Hey, V'lo yekli gever alisha, V'lo yelbash gever simlat isha, ki toavat Hashem elokecha kol oseh ela. A woman must not put on man's apparel, nor shall a man wear women's clothing. For whoever does these things is abhorrent to God. Notice the word toeva is used, something that's not mentioned that often in the pants discussion. Because male homosexual sex, of course, is referred to as a toeva, and that often gets waved around as if, well, it can never be permitted. Look, it's an abomination. Now, I find that the word toeva is brandished much less in any conversations about women wearing men's clothing, which suggests to me, again, a calmer societal acceptance, whether we like it, whether we don't, whether we think it's a prohibition, whether we don't, around the topic of pants, certainly today in modern Orthodoxy. But I do want to point out that the word toeva appears here, and then the question is, for interpreters, well, what are we talking about? What causes it to be an abomination, a toeva, something that's abhorrent in the eyes of God? And if we would go through the Rishonim, even earlier, the Talmudic analysis, and then the Rishonim, really it boils down to two concerns. One is for the kind of cross-dressing that leads to promiscuity. Men who dress up as women in order to infiltrate the women's camp, meaning the women's locker rooms, for lack of a better word, in order to look like women, act like women, and then allow themselves to be exposed to the close presence and proximity and intimacy of women when they're among one another, and vice versa for women who try to cross-dress and infiltrate the camps of men in order to fornicate, to be promiscuous, to achieve some sort of sexual conquest. And the other possibility is for idolatry. Both of those say literally all of the interpretations and commentators are reflective of the toeva, of the abomination. But wearing cross-dressing or wearing articles belonging to the opposite sex for warmth, to protect oneself from the elements, possibly for fashion, not related to promiscuity. I'm leaving that on the side because no one says that directly, but one can extrapolate that from the sources. Anything that's not for sexuality or for idolatry would not be biblically prohibited. That seems to be very clear from the Rambam, from the Sefer Achinuch, from the Ibn Ezra, from the Tor. The Shulchan Aruch is a little more conservative, or his language is less clear, but all of the commentaries around say, well, clearly if a woman is wearing it for protection, if she's wearing it not to resemble a man, or a man is not wearing it to resemble a woman, but he's doing it for another reason, that would be okay. Of course, that leaves on the side the question of transgender who are cross-dressing to resemble the opposite gender. I'm not going to go into that in this talk. I would say that the cleanest reading of the sources would consider that kind of cross-dressing a problem, although they didn't really understand sexual identity or changes in sexual identity through clothing, which would not be the same as promiscuity and idolatry. So there might be a way to develop an analysis in that direction. Okay, so what I want to put on the table at this point is erva, we saw, is defined in the halachic sources as related to Kriyat Shema. Cross-dressing for the purposes of promiscuity or for the purposes of idolatry is absolutely prohibited. It's an abomination and abhorrent to God. But that does not seem to reflect fashion trends towards men wearing women's accessories and women wearing men's clothing. The more common until recently was women wearing men's clothing, men's suits, men's pants, and so on. So much so that the fashion industry started making boyfriend jeans or men's clothing tailored for women, for women's body types and sizes, which are different than men. And so that space was not addressed in the halachic literature. And so the question is, when we come to pants today, what are we going to find in the halachic sources? And I want to turn your attention to the source sheet again, because we're going to look at the way a few early achronim, really sages, halachic authorities in the 20th century looked at the advent of pants. And we're going to see the language is not a strictly halachic language. In other words, when I teach classes in halacha, I often show how we start with a pasuk and then an interpretation of the verse, and then we go to the Mishnah and the Talmud and we look at the Tosefta, meaning we look at rabbinic literature and how they interact with the verse, if there's a biblical anchor in any particular case. If there isn't, then we start with the Mishnah and we work onward. We look at how the Rishonim analyze. We look at how the Achronim, meaning we really do an exploration of the evolution of a halachic idea or concept and how it shifts and moves and ebbs and flows depending on the interpreter, the posek, the halachic authority. And here we're going to find out that the language is going to be very demonic and very negative and very anti, but it's not going to have the same kind of anchoring I normally find in responsa, where I use earlier precedents to argue my point. Instead, we're going to see that the point is going to be argued very aggressively, but without the kind of legalistic language that often anchors or always anchors halachic conversations. And I think that ties into where I started. This is less a halachic conversation and more of a religious conversation. It's really a holy war, a religious war, because again, I want my women to dress in a way that reflects their identity and commitment to religious life and community. And I also want to desexualize the space so that men and women can interact more freely, since that's what's happening anyway. And so those concerns are going to kind of come to a head as the subject of pants comes up. And we're going to read a few of these tshuvas that were translated by Getzel Ellenson, Zichrono Levracha, may he rest in peace, who did a masterful job of presenting this topic in his book, A Way of Life, I think it is, where he looked at different topics having to do with women in halacha. And so we're going to start with the Avnei Tzedek, Rav Yekutiel Teitelbaum, who was murdered in the Holocaust. During the winter, are women allowed to wear trousers under their clothing as protection against the cold? So his answer is, one may rely upon the view of Bach and Taz, commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch, that even an outright male garment is permissible if worn as protection against the cold. The Shach, another commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, forbade only a man's dressing up so one cannot tell he's a man. Again, this builds on my introduction that the cross-dressing prohibition in the Torah is to mislead people into thinking a man is a woman or a woman is a man for promiscuity and for idolatry. But one could even wear a clearly male garment. He's using protection from the cold, but I don't think it's hard to extrapolate towards fashion as well. His entire focus is on the person, not his garb, such that if a man wears only one female garment and does not intend to resemble the opposite sex, this violates no prohibition. Surely trousers beneath a woman's clothing, or even over them, are permissible, since the woman will ultimately be recognized as such by her other clothing, and since she is only wearing this garment as protection from the cold. Yet even without my answer, there is still no problem, for after investigation, I have become aware that women's trousers can be distinguished from men's, being that the two are different. Thus, there are two points in your favor to allow women to wear trousers as protection against the cold. Number one, there is no intent to resemble men. And number two, the trousers are different from a man's, both here and in Poland, he's in Hungary. Even pious, modest women have long practiced this without a complaint being heard. Now, Avnei Tzedek is talking about special loose-fitting work trousers. That's clear. He's not talking about skinny jeans or leggings. He then talks about a greater problem is the new phenomena of women wearing men's hats and suits, which is very interesting because until Annie Hall, I didn't realize this was Woody Allen's movie Annie Hall. I didn't realize there was also a fashion trend in, I guess, the 30s and 40s in Europe, for women to wear men's hats and suits. These would seem to be forbidden, and I have previously made an uproar about this, demanding that their forbidden status be publicized. He says, many trespassed in this regard as well by wearing non-Jewish fashions. May God have mercy upon us. But again, he doesn't state clearly why they would be forbidden. Maybe, again, the non-Jewish fashion piece, which might be akin to idolatry. I don't think he's going to cross-dressing because nonetheless, you'd still be able to tell women are women. They're not intending to resemble men to hide their gender identity. But it's unclear. Okay. We're now going to move on. So the Avnei Tzedek comes out permitting pants that are not specifically, certainly if they're different from men's and there's no intent to resemble men. Now let's take a look at the Minchat Yitzchak. Notice the language. Is there any prohibition against women wearing women's slacks, which are like trousers but are never worn by men and are distinguishable by such factors as color? The answer. This question does not require elaborate investigation, for an outright prohibition is involved. Now, what he doesn't do is state what the prohibition is. Besides, ostentatious clothing such as this is produced a priori for sin and is associated with promiscuity. So besides the outright prohibition, which he hasn't clearly stated, he really now throws in his thesis, which clothing like this is associated with promiscuity and is meant for sin. Even if they are not classed as male articles, wearing them is an abominable act. And then he says they are real male articles, even if they're a bit different, they're still labeled trousers. He disagrees with the Avnei Tzedek. And then he says once a girl reaches educable age, she must be taught about this like any other mitzvah. He calls these forbidden fruits. He talks about wearing that home is obviously forbidden. He talks about whether she can wear them to go skiing, better she should stay home and not dress this way, especially as a Torah prohibition is involved. So the only thing I can guess is he's talking about the Torah prohibition not to wear male clothing. But as I've said, all of the earlier sources, the entire precedent rests on wearing male clothing in order to resemble a man and cross-dress and mislead people into thinking you're a man. And that's not what's happening here with these fashions. So we're taking something and we're absolutely exploding onto what seemed to be a very clear prohibition, something different, something that clearly a situation that is threatening the religious norms and culture and behavior. And so we take something and we reinterpret very drastically, very dramatically, very aggressively. And we don't really explain so much what the outright prohibition is. Okay, take a look at the Tzitz Eliezer, who is really, I'm very fond of the Tzitz Eliezer, and I use him when I teach medical halacha. Very interesting and creative thinker. And here, too, we're going to see something that shows how threatening the pants conversation is. Our greatest legal authorities have raised their voices against those who, by seeing a pretext for leniency regarding women's trousers, have made themselves scoundrels with Torah approval. They have ruled that the Torah simply forbids such trousers with these words, a woman shall not wear male articles. Okay. Clearly, none of the halachic differentiations presented by the poskim apply to shameful garments such as these. By their very nature, their abominable arrogance is evident for all to see, as are the lustful thoughts of those who wear them. By exposing the shape of the leg and by accentuating the figure, they are the living fulfillment of they make a tinkling with their feet. It goes without saying that they are forbidden in terms of kli gever. So again, he's saying it goes without saying, but what he's not doing is refuting the earlier interpretations of kli gever, which literally means the articles of a man, right, wearing men's clothing. He doesn't then explain why he is allowed to forbid it based on the clear interpretations of the Rambam, of the Gemara, the Rambam, that it really is only when it is intended to cross-dress for the purpose of tricking other people into thinking they're men and for fornication and so on. He's using those ideas and bringing them into a situation in which that's not really what's happening. Okay, and this idea of exposing the shape of the leg, he doesn't say it directly, but it's possible what he's referring to is the shok b'isha erva, the thigh of a woman is erva. If you can see the shape of the thigh, that might be erva. Now, again, that would be for kriyat shema if I'm being halachic, but religiously, we don't really care about kriyat shema. We care about desexualizing sacred and non-sacred space. The shok becomes a source of erva that is relevant 24/7, and so wearing pants then exposes the shape of the leg. Such trousers lay a wicked trap just to finish to ensnare young Jewish males in the net of promiscuity. They are almost certainly to be considered accoutrements of fornication. Hidden in their very shape and form is a poisonous incitement to sexually forbidden acts. Now, I often point out to my students that when language becomes so demonic and so aggressive, it often is meant to hide the fact that I don't really have a clear halachic argument against them. Meaning when I'm this aggressive and I'm this threatened, then really it's because I can't directly say, oh, here's your isur. You know, people aren't going to eat pork because I have a clear prohibition to eat pork. I'm not going to eat a cheeseburger because I have a clear prohibition. There are certain things that are very, very clear. And so I don't have to spend a lot of time arguing against them. The fact that I'm using the language of a wicked trap and accoutrements of fornication and so on certainly reflects the desire to reinforce the holy war against pants, but I don't have the easy arsenal I have when I have a clear prohibition. Okay. The next source I want to look at, the Yaskel Avdi, again, number 4, just to continue this thread. Kli Gever is not violated unless a man or woman wear trousers distinctly suited to the opposite sex. So he agrees that, again, it would have to be something distinctly suited. Today, men and women have gender-neutral pants, meaning women wear men's pants, men wear women's pants. Gender has kind of been taken out of a lot of the clothing that we wear. For a different reason, however, they should be forbidden to women. So notice he's not going to go with Kli Gever. Trousers are a wild, promiscuous, and immodest garment for women, since legs are separated from each other to the very top. So that really becomes the issue. We haven't seen this anywhere. I mean, this is a new fashion trend. Never have we had women dressed in such a way that legs are separated from each other to the very top. I don't even have a source to turn to say, oh, it's forbidden because of this. But it's so clearly prohibited. It's so clearly irrelevant to any sort of religious conversation. I'm not even going to go there as to what kind of pants. I'm not even going to prove to you that where the prohibition is. It's clear that there's a prohibition, and I'm just going to talk around it. One who sees a woman wearing trousers may be led to sinful thought or even to fornication. Unfortunately, there is no longer any separation between young men and women, all mingled together at work and school. For this reason, trousers should be forbidden to women. So I feel like the Yaskel Avdi finally says what I have been suggesting throughout my reading of these sources. I don't really have any clear prohibition. It is absolutely forbidden, meaning especially now that men and women are mingling, trousers should be forbidden to women. And that leads me to Rav Ovadia, who really, as he goes through his tshuva, says, I'm going to skip a little bit, to every reason is sufficient independently to make this permissible. In other words, Rav Ovadia, who really is one of my favorite halachic thinkers, says this isn't a halachic conversation, meaning for every argument you give me, I can deflect it. It's not halacha. I can use, there are lots of ways in which I can permit pants. Every reason independently, meaning there are lots of independent reasons. Even so, I admit that a priori, one should not allow young women to wear trousers, since they are an arrogant form of dress that arouses the attentions of onlookers more than a normal skirt or dress and provokes sinful thought. Fine Jewish girls should not wear them at all, especially those that really cling to the body, for they cause men to stare and to entertain especially sinful thoughts. Okay, and so the Yaskel Avdi started this, I would say, honest acknowledgement of what the concern is with pants. He's not going to try to use halachic analysis. The Yabia Omer, Rav Ovadia and the Yabia Omer continues that. And then he says, I don't, you could permit it, but we don't want to permit it. And then he finally says, if girls are going to wear short skirts and go out with their legs bared, then they should wear trousers, meaning trousers are better than short skirts. And it's so interesting because I think he's right, given the way I look around and I teach young women and so on. There's no question a pair of jeans compared to a short skirt without stockings or leggings would be more modest. And yet pants have become taboo. You can't have a rational conversation, as Rav Ovadia is trying to have. You can't determine what is preferred or not preferred because pants have become taboo based on everything we've just seen, fornication and abomination and what it's going to lead to and so on. And really, as I said, it's a holy war, meaning we want women to dress a certain way. We want women's identity to reflect their religious commitment. Pants have become, first of all, very ubiquitous in society, very much ubiquitous of non-Jewish culture. And so in order to keep women looking religious, we're going to use the skirt. And Getzel Ellenson, and really it's the last source we're going to look at, he talks about the fact that to a certain extent in the last few decades, the skirt has become a sort of yarmulke for the scrupulously observant girl who strives to follow our sages' ethical guidelines. By her refusal to wear trousers, she demonstrably declares that she is unwilling to resign herself to the dictates of modern style and that she takes exception to the immorality so rampant these days in society at large. Okay, and so you can continue to read Getzel Ellenson yourself, but I think what he says is very important, meaning men have kippah and tzitzit. Men have external signs outside of the Haredi and Hasidic world, where in the Haredi world they wear a black suit and a white shirt and a hat or a big black kippah. And obviously in the Hasidic world, each community has its own nuances of dress. In the modern Orthodox world, what modern Orthodox men have are tzitzit and kippah. The tzitzit they most likely keep tucked in. But the kippah is something that really sets them apart, so that if I'm walking down the street and I see a man with a kippah, I know, oh, he's a landsman. He's one of us. Women don't have anything that obvious. And so really, I think part of the conversation here, and this is where I say I think there is a legitimacy to this, not a halachic legitimacy as much as a religious concern and legitimacy to that concern, is how are we going to create identity through dress for women? We don't want them wearing kippah and tzitzit. That's something that reflects the reform and the conservative movements who are not as committed to halacha anyway and really have feminist agendas. Again, I'm paraphrasing. I'm not saying this personally. And so the idea of a woman wearing a skirt to define her commitment, in addition to the fact that I think there really is a fear that jeans, that pants, are far more sexually provocative than what should be a loose skirt, a skirt that covers the knee, a skirt that has a certain shape and cut and can be more clearly defined, is something that is very relevant over the last 50 to 100 years, meaning what are our women going to look like? And I will say in Israel, something interesting has happened, and I think it was because of the religious kibbutzim, but it took off after that as well, of women who once they got married, covering their hair and wearing pants. And so saying, okay, I'm going to create my identity and my commitment through my head covering, through my hair covering, but that way I can wear pants so it's clear, like a kippah, where I belong. But that, you know, doesn't really resolve the problem for women who are single, and it's less acceptable, I believe, in the United States. So as we come to the conclusion, I hope what I've started to map out for you is that the concerns over women in religious communities, what that space looks like, the concern for sexuality or desexualizing, and how that plays out as genders continue to mix more and more frequently really is illustrated well by the conversation we just had, where we looked at halachic sources, saw really the conversation about pants is less halachic and more a religious conversation, and that will help us move to the next topic, which is going to be hair covering, although, of course, you can listen to these podcasts in any order that you like. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Uncovered with Rabbanit Nechama Goldman Barish, a podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. Visit www.elmad.pardes.org for more in this series and other great content.